Greetings, I'm Sue, and this is the Lynn Daily Item for April 8th, 2026. First article. Swampscott hears from its candidates. Voters got a preview of this year's town election Tuesday night as candidates for select board and school committee took the stage at Swampscott High School for a public forum. The forum was moderated by the item's editorial director, Sophia Harris, and comes ahead of the April 28th town election, where four candidates are competing for two open select board seats, while three school committee candidates are running unopposed for seats that will still shape the district's direction. About 50 residents turned up to hear the candidates speak. The forum was also broadcast by Swampscott TV, and a recording is available on the town's YouTube page. The school committee portion of the forum featured Martha Driscoll Cesars, a former teacher and principal at Stanley Elementary School, and John Giantis, a finance and legal professional who has served on the committee for 6 years. Katie Arrington, who was also running, could not attend the forum. Giantis and Cesars both said they were looking ahead to the work of the committee and the role they could play in it. Giantis, who is seeking a third term, pointed to the balance he has tried to bring to the role. The focus has to remain on serving students, not just now, but over time, he said. Over the past 6 years, I feel like I've developed a clear understanding of that balance between listening and deciding, between supporting people and staying accountable, between immediate needs and long-term sustainability. Cesars, drawing on her background in education, said she hopes to bring a more open and communicative approach to the committee. My responsibility on the school committee is to actively seek things, listen carefully to all viewpoints, and paint a broad understanding of the important issues confronting the schools and town, she said. All four select board candidates, Wayne Spritz, Charlie Patsios, Ted Dooley, and Wayne Godfrey, attended, setting up the night's only contested race. Dooley, who chairs both the Planning Board and Harbor and Waterfront Advisory Committee, framed the town's financial challenges as requiring new approaches beyond cuts or tax increases. We can't cut anymore. I don't think we can increase taxes anymore. We need to rely on more economic development in this town, and I have the experience to do that, Dooley said, referencing his involvement in the Vinon Square rezoning. Those investments are going to bring in hundreds of thousands of dollars in new growth to our community. Godfrey, a town meeting member and outreach coordinator for the Swampscott Democratic Town Committee, pointed to the town's structural financial pressures, particularly around school funding. We have billion-dollar problems in this town that we can't tax our way out of, Godfrey said. I intend to use my advocacy skills and my connections to state and federal partners to place pressure and hopefully open up those lockboxes. Patsios, who chairs the Housing Authority and serves on multiple town committees, emphasized the need to better leverage revenue sources and infrastructure planning. Our building department brings in roughly $800,000 of revenue. We're limiting the number of hours that they can work, Patsios said. We need to take that back to 40-plus hours. That's a profit center for the town. Spritz, an engineer and longtime member of several committees, most recently as the chair of the Water and Sewer Advisory Board, said his approach would focus on process, data, and consensus building. Facts matter. Details matter. Process matters, Spritz said. And most of all, teamwork and alignment matters. That means listening carefully before you make choices and trusting your team. Much of the discussion centered on how the town should manage growing financial pressures, with candidates broadly agreeing on the need for new revenue. Dooley repeatedly pointed to commercial growth and development as a key to easing the burden on taxpayers, while Patsios focused on restructuring town systems and identifying underused revenue opportunities. Godfrey emphasized advocacy and potential partnerships beyond the local level, and Spritz stressed long-term planning and decision-making grounded in data. The town's financial situation was also brought up as candidates discussed several major projects currently facing the town, including the rail trail and the future of the General John Glover Farmhouse, both of which have drawn significant public attention. On the rail trail, candidates broadly supported completing the project, though they differed in how to move it forward. Dooley pointed to the gap between the town's approval of the project and its execution. It's a great idea, but we haven't been able to do is have an honest conversation about how we are going to complete it, he said. We need to do better at executing on our public policy. When we have set a policy like this, we need to do it right. Spritz echoed that support while emphasizing the need to resolve ongoing logistical and financial challenges. I do think the rail trail should be completed. I think it could be a community gem, Pritz said. What I'm frustrated with is that since 2017, town meeting allotted about $850,000 to move the project along. My goal will be to bring the groups together to find a way through this. On the Glover House, candidates also agreed on the importance of preservation, while also stressing important questions to be answered on cost and long-term viability. Patsio said that he believes the farmhouse should be saved, and the town should explore available funding tools to support its restoration. It's a national treasure that's located in Swampscott, Massachusetts, he said, mentioning that he himself is a monthly donor to the preservation efforts. I believe that CPA funds can be used for a project like that. If we know where we can look, I know we can do better. Godfrey, meanwhile, emphasized the scale of the challenge and the need for broader support beyond the local level. I do, in fact, support preserving the Glover. There's an opportunity to preserve an absolutely beautiful piece of history, he said. There has to be a private-public partnership that is sustainable over the years, and that needs to be generational. We really do need to ask for help from the Commonwealth and our federal partners. Throughout the discussion, candidates repeatedly stressed that strong communication and connections, both among select board members and between the board and the public, would be key to navigating those challenges and building trust around major decisions. Voters will now weigh their options in the weeks leading up to the April 28th election. Next article, new and improved Republic Recycling opens in Peabody. To celebrate the grand opening of the 54,000 square foot Peabody Recycling Center located at 109 Newbury Street, Republic Services marked the occasion with a ribbon cutting before showing off the facility's new upgrades on Tuesday. The facility was built in 2015, and in 2023, when Republic acknowledged the need to better its systems, Machinex Technologies was contracted to take on the project. It was then closed from April to December of last year for the improvements to be made. Despite its name, the Peabody Recycling Center is not recycling anything on the site. Rather, it is sorting and collecting recyclable materials so they can be reused in the future. The new material recoveries facility, the approximately 40-foot structure of new equipment needed for daily operations, features ballistic sorters, a sophisticated conveyor system, eddy current separators, and enhanced safety systems, including a new fire rover system. Additionally, the various improvements increase the facility's output to 35 to 40 tons per hour. Peabody Recycling Center is a state-of-the-art facility designed to make precise recycling processing much better, said Brian Scan, Republic Services General Manager. This 54,000 square foot facility is home to new equipment, much empowered by AI technologies. This new infrastructure utilizes AI to separate the materials brought to the facility more effectively, ultimately creating a cleaner product. Sustainability is in our DNA at Republic Services, Skian said. We are firmly committed to providing sustainable solutions for our customers throughout the greater Boston area. Kathy Mirza, branch chief for the Massachusetts Department of Environmental Protection's Municipal Waste Reduction Program, said she was quite impressed with the new facility and that she appreciated how it will assist with waste reduction. We have very ambitious goals for the state to reduce waste by 30% by 2030, and we know that recycling and the capacity to recycle more are very important parts of that equation, Mirza said. Machinex Technologies Inc. Senior Project Manager Chris Hayes explained that there are cameras throughout the facility and within the necessary equipment that monitor the entire conveyor belt system. Via those cameras AI is used to identify objects based on their shape and composition. Imagine taking 100 million pictures of an aluminum can crushed every way possible. Then it loads it into the neural network, and it's able to identify it based on its two-dimensional shape on the belt, Hayes said. The database then tells the AI which objects are meant to go where throughout the system. Republic Services Operation Manager Joe Gano added that the AI learns along the way, and Machine X is able to make tweaks and adjustments as we give them information as well. So, if there is waste found where it shouldn't be, Republic can fix the project by updating the AI software. Gano emphasized that the AI isn't taking away from human jobs, though, as people are needed to double-check the machine's work throughout the sorting process. This is our optical sorter, Gano said, approaching one of the many machines within the new structure. This is using AI technology to sort paper. This right here is making sure that anything that's paper is dropping down and going into this room here. The AI does the work and sends it into this room. Our manual sorters look and say, yep, okay, AI did what it's supposed to do, or AI missed that. I'm going to grab that out. Pointing around the facility, Gano added, we do that here with the paper. Up there, there's some cardboard, and these two back ones here, one is for PET, polyethylene terephthalate, and this one is for mixed paper. Pretty much there's an AI component to everything that we're sorting, but then there's a human face behind there that's the last chance line. What stood out to Gano about the new facility was that there's grand improvements in equipment. Likely the infinitely bigger end feeder, where the material goes, can equally translate into grand impacts made for the approximately 35 staff members, as they now have heat and air conditioning available in their sorting cabins and for the environment. This is so great for Republic Services because it's allowing us to use technology and to use people to get the best commodity, the best sort separation that we can, Gano said. It's allowing us to take in more tons per hour, which is allowing us to increase our sustainable footprint by soliciting more customers to bring us more recyclable materials. So we're extremely excited to be here and to be able to take in more recycling. Next article, a piece of 1828 Lynn history returns. On Tuesday evening, the Lynn Historical Commission discussed an 1828 restraining order from Lynn that was found in Stockbridge. The document was sent to the commission by a curator at the Stockbridge Library, Museum, and Archives after a resident discovered it. In a note accompanying the find, the sender wrote, "I found this old warrant tucked into an old book that was in the basement," adding, "Put it between the cardboard and thought you might be interested in it for the library. If not, pass it on or dispose of it. Hopefully, it's of some interest." Commission members examined the fragile document during the meeting, with member Wendy Joseph noting that this needs to be on acid-free paper. As they worked through the faded handwriting, they determined the warrant functioned as an early form of a restraining order. The handwritten text describes a complaint filed in Essex County in 1828 in which a man alleged that John Ireson and his wife Elvira hath threatened to beat them and to do them bodily mischief, and that he feared they would follow through. The complaint states it was made not for any private malice, hatred, or ill will, but simply because he is afraid and calls for authorities to apprehend the couple and requires assurances of good behavior. Members noted the difficulty of deciphering portions of the document, with Chair Paul O'Leary remarking, "A lot of it is kind of difficult to read," while member Carl Greenler suggested it could be enlarged for clarity. The commission also debated where the historical document should ultimately be housed. "That was something I did want to discuss as to what to do with it," O'Leary said, weighing whether it belonged with a historical society or the library. Joseph expressed concern about accessibility if placed in a museum collection, noting, even if you put stuff in there, you hardly get an appointment to see your own stuff. It was argued that the document should remain publicly accessible. "It should be in the library," Wendy added. "It should be some way people can see it. as opposed to touching it, Secretary Pat Lee said. Ultimately, the commission agreed to offer the document to the trustees of the Lynn Public Library, aiming to preserve it while ensuring it remains accessible to the public. Next article, LHAND approves $1.9 million for fire safety. During the Monday evening meeting, the Lynn Housing and Authority Neighborhood Development, LHAND, Board of Commissioners accepted two emergency awards totaling approximately $1.9 million for the replacement of the fire alarm systems. Charles Mijos of the Procurement and Facilities Department shared that the project was voted on in last month's meeting. The Board of Commissioners voted on the engineer for the project, Mijos stated, to have them design the plans for the fire alarm at these properties. Mijos also stated that there was originally a gap in the funding where LHAND needed additional funds. EOHLC, Executive Office of Housing and Livable Communities, was able to provide us with these parts of money. One for project number 163171, that is the McGee House, Essex and Tilton, and Shepherd and Warren, and the other part of the money, 163170, is Caggiano Plaza, he said. The EOHLC Emergency Award communication was $572,482 for the deteriorated alarm systems of McGee House with 49 units, Essex and Tilton with 47 units, and Shepherd and Warren with 28 units. The award for the replacement of Caggiano Plaza's 107-unit system was $1,388,475. Caggiano Plaza will not just be getting its fire alarm system replaced, but also its sprinklers. In February, the plaza on South Common Street suffered a sprinkler pipe burst on the 10th floor. While there were no injuries, there were damages to the property, having to temporarily relocate for residents. Good news is that hopefully we can get started on this project as soon as possible, Mijos said. I think that the bidding schedule was mid-April, and the architects were going to begin advertising for this. Next article, developer files appeal against Safe Harbor in Saugus. It has been confirmed that the developer of the 20 Rear Bennett Highway apartment project has filed an appeal with the Housing Appeals Committee against the Safe Harbor appeal made by the Zoning Board of Appeals. The board originally announced it would file for Safe Harbor at a January 22nd meeting and later at a March 26th meeting announced that the Massachusetts Executive Office of Housing and Livable Communities upheld the appeal. However, the developer had until Tuesday, April 7th, to file for an appeal. Safe Harbor allows a municipality to temporarily deny or restrict comprehensive permit applications for affordable housing developments without facing state-level appeals. Now, the developer has the opportunity to state their case in their own appeal. If the Safe Harbor claim prevails, the matter is returned to the board and it could deny the project. However, if the developer prevails, the matter is remanded to the board and the public hearing continues. Next article, Peabody knows the recipe for kindness. As a way to remember and honor Jason Bernard, the 14-year-old Higgins Middle School student who died by suicide last May due to bullying, the Jason Legacy Foundation, alongside Peabody Promise and Peabody Public Schools, has begun its first annual Jay's Cookies, A Recipe for Kindness, an event that combines Jason's love of baking with a reminder for kids to choose kindness. Known for his curiosity, ambition, and big dreams, Jason had one hobby that stood above the rest, baking cookies. A cup of laughter, one caring smile, a sprinkle of hope, and a whole lot of love. These are the ingredients we want our students to carry with them, said Celie Rosario, Jason's sister and the founder of Jason's Legacy Foundation. Jay's Cookies is about more than just a sweet treat. It's a reminder to every student to choose kindness every single day. To honor his life, the Jason's Legacy Foundation was established to promote mental health awareness, bullying prevention, and community kindness. The foundation provides resources and programs like Jace Cookies designed to remind students to always choose kindness. By pairing Jason's favorite hobby with a powerful anti-bullying message, the foundation is committed to fostering a culture of belonging and ensuring that Jason's memory continues to inspire a world where every student feels seen, valued, and loved. This cookie-gram exchange is coordinated through the Peabody Veterans Memorial High School Culinary Arts Program and sponsored by the class of 2029, which would have been Jason's graduating class. The culinary students will be baking cookies with Jason's recipe next week to fulfill the orders put in from now until Friday, April 10th. Rosario said using his cookie recipe is a way to keep his memory alive and share happy moments with Peabody students. Cookies are $1 each, and proceeds will be split between the class of 2029 and Jason's Legacy Foundation. Rosario said all funds garnered for the foundation will go towards its scholarship fund. Each cookie comes with a kindness message, which were finalized by the class of 2029 student officers. The four messages people can choose from are, you're appreciated. Be the reason someone smiles today. In a world where you can be anything, be kind. And kindness is free. Pass it on. Additionally, Dorsey's Bakery and Delicatessen donated 1,400 cookies to Higgins Middle School students, and each came with a Jay's Cookies, a Recipe for Kindness sticker. Rosario said this served as a reminder that something tragic happened here, but look at how we're turning something so sad into something positive. She added that there will be an anti-bullying essay contest for sixth graders next month, and the winner will receive a $100 Amazon gift card. Next article, Nahant approves new parking policy. The Nahant Housing Authority Board has approved a proposed policy aimed at addressing a long-standing shortage of available parking spaces at one of its properties. The proposal, introduced by Executive Director Kelly Collins, would establish a former set of rules for parking at the authority's Chapter 667 housing development. Currently, the property has no official written policy governing parking use. The need for a structured policy stems from a significant imbalance between available parking and demand. According to Collins, the property includes just 19 total parking spaces, 14 standard and 5 handicap accessible, which serves a much larger group of residents. The issue has been under discussion for several months. The topic of creating a formal parking policy was first raised during the board's January meeting, with continued revisions through February and March. I started by asking other local housing authorities for their policies, and the board and I reviewed those samples, she explained. We put together what we thought to be the best information from those samples, in addition to how we currently handle the lack of parking. As discussions progressed, Collins described the process as iterative, with multiple versions and outside input considered. Conversations with external contacts such as Town Administrator Allison Nieto and Selectman Robert Thibault helped inform the policy, though they understand our concerns, but obviously they can't make decisions, Collins shared, leaving further input to be reviewed through appropriate channels. The proposal focuses primarily on clarifying how limited parking resources are allocated. It outlines the spaces are not assigned to specific units except for handicap spaces tied to designated accessible units. It also establishes how initial parking assignments are made and what residents must do to retain them over time. I think it keeps everybody who has designated parking spots now currently happy, Collins stated, but I think it makes stipulations as to if you have a spot, how you keep that spot. It's one thing to get a spot, but it's how you keep that spot going forward. Under the proposed rules, residents would need to meet specific criteria to maintain a parking space, including being the primary driver of the vehicle, maintaining occupancy requirements, and providing documentation such as registration and a valid driver's license. So long as you meet that criteria, you have your spot, Collins explained. The policy also addresses how additional or visitor parking is handled. Rather than designating formal visitor spaces, the plan refers to an unpaved parking area located at the rear of the lot. This area would operate on a first-come, first-served basis and would be used for second vehicles or guest parking. In addition, the proposal includes a process for residents to indicate their parking needs, whether they currently have a space, do not need one, or would like to be considered for one in the future. The board also discussed plans to number each parking space and install signage to make assignments clearer for residents. While members acknowledge the possibility of future revisions, they emphasize the urgency of implementing a policy now. It's coming to a point now that certain people are really aggravating the people who live here, Chairman David Wilson said. Ultimately, the board expressed support for moving forward with the current version, even if changes are made later. I think that for the moment in time that we are in, this is the best we can do, Collins said. Because there is no existing form and policy, the proposal would mark the first time the authority codifies how parking is allocated and managed at the site. Next article, Saugus Board bans Kratom. The Board of Health held a public hearing Monday night regarding the banning of the sale and manufacturing of Kratom, both natural and synthetic, in town. The ban passed in a 4-1 vote, with member Dr. Anthony Bakopoulos casting the lone no vote. Public Health Director John Fralick began the discussion by reading the statement of the purpose for the ban. Whereas Kratom, a tree-like plant, is indigenous to Southeast Asia, produces a stimulant and sedative effect when orally ingested in tablet, capsule, or extract form, Fralick read, Kratom leaves can be chewed or dried or ingested as tea. Use of Kratom can lead to psychotic symptoms and psychological or physiological dependence. The statement noted that there were several instances of overdoses and abuse documented across the United States, and that the vote would ban the manufacturer, sale, and distribution of Kratom in town. Resident Mike Fisher spoke during public comment, emphasizing that there were a major difference between synthetic and natural Kratom, and that while he thinks that there should be regulations, it shouldn't be an outright ban of all Kratom products. They are 100% unrelated and should be treated as such. Natural leaf Kratom has mitragynine in it, which is an active ingredient. When that product is processed through chemicals and synthetics and synthesis, it turns into a totally different product, which is 7-hydroxymitragynine, or 7-OH, Fisher said. Fisher agreed that the synthetic product should not be easily obtained on convenience store shelves, but that the natural leaf should just have restrictions such as an age limit. The big misconception is that people group these two things together and they are not the same, noting that major convenience stores like Circle K and 7-Eleven do a vigorous vetting process and all carry the natural leaf product. Yes, it should be regulated, but it's not for children. We are not labs. We can't scrutinize the label on every product and majority of these products, said Joyce Redford. Bakopoulos said he may agree with the board on the ban, but it felt too big brotherous to vote on the ban as a natural substance. Unfortunately, that's all the time that we have for this article today, and that was not a complete reading of that article. Thank you for listening to the Lynn Daily News on the Talking Information Center.